Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. A bit later, an excerpt of my Fitzgerald Theater conversation with Sheryl Sandberg on Friday. But now, in depth on the real science of life on other planets.
Mr. Chambers, don't get on that ship. The rest of the book, To Serve Men, it's a cookbook.
That Twilight Zone episode says it all about the relationship between aliens and Hollywood. Visitors from other planets were either here to enslave us, eliminate us, or dine on us. If you remember the movie District 9, it was a contemporary take on the arrival of an invading force of aliens who come to Earth to escape their own dying planet. Well, British astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell writes in a new collection of essays, "I suspect that if aliens did come to Earth, it would be as researchers, biologists, anthropologists, linguists, keen to understand the peculiar workings of life on Earth." Today, a conversation about the ongoing quest for life on other planets and our complicated relationship with the idea of extraterrestrial beings. As our guest joins us, I'd like you to let your imagination roam. What do you think our concept of aliens, which clearly shaped by movies and science fiction, tells us about who we are as humans on Earth? So I'd like you to take a bit of measure of this idea that we have of what aliens are from the books that we read and the movies that we see, and then think about this a little bit as to what it says about who we are as humans on this planet. Here's a phone number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. And our guest is Jim Al-Khalili. He's a physicist, writer, and BBC broadcaster. He's the editor of a new book of essays called Aliens, the World's Leading Scientists on the Search for Extraterrestrial Life. And he's with us today from Surrey, England. And Jim, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for having me on.
Do you think Hollywood has done us and them, whoever they are, a disservice when it comes to aliens?
Well, certainly Hollywood has reflected our obsession with painting aliens in our own image. So all the alien movies and but all the conspiracy theories about what intelligent aliens look like, they always have, you know, a head, two eyes, a nose, mouth, two arms, two legs. And we've just created them in our image. And there's absolutely no reason to think that if complex life exists somewhere else out beyond our planet, then it should look anything like us or anything like any life here on Earth at all.
Why do we so often imagine that this will be an adversarial relationship? Because, I mean, if Lewis Dartnell is right, this would be anything but adversarial. It would be a quest for knowledge, not an idea to dominate the planet Earth.
I think this just goes back throughout human history. We've always been nervous of some invading group who want what we have, you know, whether it's the conquering of the new world, whether it's armies of one civilization or dynasty conquering the nearby nations. I mean, we've always had it. So we imagine extrapolating that and think that maybe if an alien civilization comes to Earth, then clearly they're just going to want to control us and steal our resources and eat us or whatever it is that the Hollywood movies are obsessed with.
Are you a big science fiction reader?
I am, yes. Yes.
So I wonder what your view is of how science fiction has treated the idea of life on other planets, because I was reading that Ian Stewart essay that's part of the collection, and he says, this is interesting, a lot of the science fiction, the early science fiction about life on other planets, falls back on the concept that Americans are very familiar with, and that's cowboys and Indians. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, I mean, I think this is, you know, the frontier spirit, conquering a new world, conquering something that's unknown, that's going to give us benefits or give aliens benefits. I think that's a recurring theme in certainly in early science fiction. Ian Stewart, who wrote that chapter in the book, is actually a mathematician, a very prominent mathematician. He's written a lot of popular science books on maths, but he's also a huge sci-fi buff. He has something like 6,000 or 7,000 science fiction books, so he knows his stuff.
Wow.
And certainly sort of more modern science fiction has explored the idea that if intelligent aliens exist out there, then they are likely to look very strange. So certainly if you think about, even Hollywood has progressed beyond Close Encounters of a Third Kind and E.T. to, say, the movie Arrival, you know, where these intelligent aliens look more like an octopus than anything humanoid.
Well, so that's interesting too, because that was also what the creatures from District 9, they had, like, didn't they have kind of squid-like skin and kind of a shape of some, I mean, this is interesting that they were looking more into the ocean and the unknowns in the ocean to try to understand what some kind of sophisticated life might look like on another planet. I wonder why.
Well, I think part of that is because science itself is advancing. You know, we are learning more about the sort of exotic creatures that live under our own oceans. Very often you look at some of these creatures living in the depths of the Pacific and Atlantic. They don't look anything like anything that we could imagine. And I think, you know, science fiction writers, certainly, you know, Hollywood screenplay writers are becoming more imaginative beyond the sort of, you know, the little green men or, you know, or the greys, to imagine that, you know, life, if it evolves somewhere else very differently, yes, there will be certain things that life will need. You know, it needs a heat source. It needs to be able to consume energy in some way. But beyond that, you know, why should it be made of cells? Why should it rely on DNA? Why should it smell or see? It might use senses that we haven't even been able to imagine yet.
You know, I went back to read an old interview that Carl Sagan gave to the Rolling Stone. You're probably familiar with it, in 1973.
Mm.
And he talks about just what you've mentioned, this, the limits of our imagination and why this is so difficult to, you know, try to picture what this life, how this life might develop and what it might look like. And here's what he says. I think we're constrained in how far we can go, not by the scientific method. I think we're constrained by our minds. For the reason I mentioned before, our minds are put together the way they are because of the needs of a very different sort of existence in which human beings evolved, a hunter-gatherer society, and now we're asking that sort of brain to approach quite different circumstances. This really brought this into focus for me. What does it say to you?
Yes, I think that's right. We tend to project our own fears, our desires, our ambitions onto any other intelligent life form that might exist out in the universe. It is very difficult to try and imagine. I mean, the notion of looking for alien life until maybe a decade ago was not deemed to be a serious research topic for serious, respectable scientists. But we are having to now address it because we are getting close to learning more about whether life once existed on Mars, whether life exists under the ice of the moons of Saturn and Jupiter. We're starting to discover extrasolar planets orbiting other star systems. And we're even getting to the point where we can learn about the chemistry of the atmosphere of such planets. So scientists are starting to address this issue very, very carefully. So what are the minimum requirements needed for something that we would call living? You know, that it has to have an energy source. Does it need water, for example, you know, to bring molecules together, make them combine into some complex structure? Is it going to be carbon-based? Well, probably, in all likelihood, even if you allow your imagination to soar, carbon is still the most useful element in sort of sticking together lots of other atoms together to make complexity. But ultimately, life has to be able to store information and use that information to make copies of itself. Beyond that, anything else is possible. and that's where I think science fiction writers have the imagination and the training to free themselves from any constraints that many scientists, I think, find very difficult to do.
Jim Al-Khalili is with us this morning, and it's a conversation, if you've just gotten in with us, about the serious quest, the serious scientific quest for life on other planets. He's the editor of a new book called Aliens, the World's Leading Scientists on the Search for Extraterrestrial Life. Here's one of the things that I'm asking you to think about, because our idea of what that life might be, how it might evolve, what it looks like, are obviously shaped by the fiction that we read and the Hollywood movies, the way they've treated alien life. And so I'd like you to think about what our concept of aliens really says about how we think about ourselves. I think that's an interesting question. I'll ask Jim about that as well. But how about you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and to the phones to Robert in Golden Valley. Hi, Robert. What are you thinking about?
Well, I think this is really a fascinating discussion, and I really like the questions that your guest is asking. And I'm wondering, would life even need to be limited as much by the constraints that you've suggested? And I also want to say I'm currently reading an awesome book right now called Day for Night.
Okay.
That touches on the subject of aliens, and highly recommend it.
Is it fiction or nonfiction, Robert?
It's fiction, but it's really, really well written,
right,
by Stacy Bryan, Day for Night.
Okay, I appreciate the recommendation. And to the question, Jim.
Well, yes, it is difficult. I mean, I think, as your caller says, for scientists to be more imaginative about how life could evolve. We certainly, know that chemistry will be the same everywhere in the universe. It's the same chemical elements, with carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen. So in order to create a structure that is complex enough to be called living, because it can make copies of itself and evolve and maintain a highly ordered state, I don't care about whether it breathes air or water, whether it needs oxygen or how it eats, but it has to maintain very special state that we call living. But it still needs atoms to join together to make molecules, to make complex structures. Now, it may be that life, intelligent life elsewhere, becomes so sophisticated that it can create artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence can be stored on anything. But for something to evolve naturally, by accident, as it were, as we have seen happen here on Earth nearly 4 billion years ago, those similar conditions, we believe, should have or will exist on other planets. So we feel we can narrow things down without constraining and leaving anything off the list of possibilities.
Erica asks on Twitter, Jim, why would aliens not conquer, eat, kill us? Humans have shown the ability to do so and are doing so. We likely are animals to them. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly true that, humans have been around for, there was a recent discovery of a skull in North Africa that suggests that Homo sapiens have been around for maybe 200,000 years, not 100,000 years. But still, that's a blink of an eye on the cosmic scale. So if intelligent life exists elsewhere, there's a very good chance that it started billions of years ago. If it's still around now, it'd be much, much more advanced than us. But why they would want to come and conquer us? Well, if they have developed the technology and the spacefaring sort of sophistication to travel light years to visit Earth, then I think their motives for doing so will be not as crude as eating us. In any case, there's very little chance that they'll be made of the same cellular structure, the same DNA that life on Earth is made of, so they would not be able to metabolize us. They wouldn't be able to eat us. And conquering us, well, what's the big deal? Do they want the Earth's resources? Well, there's billions of other planets around the solar system, around the galaxy, that maybe have the minerals and chemicals that they might want. So if they do make the effort to visit us, I think it won't be quite as crude as just wanting to destroy us.
Okay, this is what I loved about this collection of essays, that you had scientists, and you included, take these questions very seriously and apply real science, like what you've just said about metabolizing humans in a life form that is probably made up of different things. I mean, these are the questions that scientists aren't just asking themselves when they've got a little free time and, you know, not doing their serious scientific work. These are serious questions. Is it because we understand, we're really getting to the place where we understand so much more about the universe and these other planets and moons?
Yes, certainly science is advancing very rapidly on several fronts that address this issue. So we're learning more about how life may have begun here on Earth. Maybe, you know, as simple organisms in the depths of the oceans called extremophiles that live near sort of these hot vents and on the seabed. We're learning more that there are many other planets that are Earth-like, orbiting other star systems. And, you know, sort of every month or two, there'd be another announcement of discovering another star system with Earth-like planets. We are studying our own solar system. So, you know, we already have Mars Rover sort of chugging around on the surface of Mars, picking up samples and checking. We're looking at the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, and we see a lot of them have liquid water under the surface of the ice, which may contain organic molecules. I was talking recently with a woman called Ellen Stofan, who was the chief scientist at NASA. Mm-hmm. She stepped down from that role a few months ago, but she was very determined to persuade the government to fund NASA to send human missions to Mars, because she is very confident that Mars billions of years ago was very much more like Earth. Wow. And therefore it could have harbored life. So we don't think there's life on Mars today. It's a dead planet. There's no atmosphere. It's not very nice. But there was a time billions of years ago when it was much more habitable. And so there will be fossilized remains of at least microbial life, bacteria of that sort on Mars, not necessarily, you know, whole skeletons of aliens.
Right.
And so these questions are very serious, and they're ones that we are actually getting close to getting an answer to.
What would have happened to a planet like Mars to make it the way it is today and uninhabitable if it was that close to the kind of atmosphere that we have on Earth?
Well, the main reason we believe is that, and we don't know why this happened, but Mars lost its magnetic field. So, you know, the Earth has a magnetic field. It's like a giant bar magnet in the center of the Earth, which is why a compass works. And the magnetic field provides this bubble wrap around our planet that protects us from solar radiation, particles from the sun and from outer space that bombard our atmosphere. The magnetic field just repels that. If the magnetic field dies and stops for whatever reason, the dynamo at the center of the Earth would stop like it did on Mars, then this radiation will just come through and destroy our atmosphere.
I see.
So we believe that's what happened to Mars. It lost its magnetic field, and then the radiation from space destroyed its atmosphere, which means it was exposed to outer space in a way that, you know, we are protected because we have this atmosphere. So it became much colder there than any life could survive with.
Denny says on Twitter, in Star Trek, the first aliens we meet are Vulcans. They're peaceful and logical, so not all sci-fi defaults to scary aliens. Can be optimistic, too. And a call here from Chris in Roseville. Hi, Chris. Hey,
hi.
Chris. Hi. What are you thinking about?
So I was thinking that, you know, you're talking about intelligent life coming here. It's one thing to say that there's life out there in the universe, but intelligent life requires very strict parameters in order to evolve. So such as we, for instance, we got to 2 feet, which allowed our brains to grow bigger. We got language, which allowed us to have ideas which go back and forth, which became writing, which allowed those ideas to be stored. So I feel like a lot of the same things which make us an intelligent society would almost have to be in other intelligent society, especially if they were to visit here, let's say, as scientists. Then they would already have to have a system designed of empiricism and of a way to test empiricism. But my point is that I don't know if the aliens would look that different, because I believe that we evolved to these things because nature said, well, this works. So, you know, while it might be a different being, I feel like the organs and the, you know, the same things that would allow us to have stimulus would have to be there in an intelligent life.
What do you think, Jim?
Very, very good point. I agree completely with Chris. I would say there are three stages. There's what many scientists would now argue is that it's highly probable that life exists beyond Earth. But it's also most likely that it's single cell sort of or simple microbial life. Life started on Earth very soon after the conditions here became could tolerate life. And so we think that maybe that stage isn't so difficult for simple life to emerge. The much more difficult stage is whether multicellular complex life could evolve. And that may be, you know, we may just be the lottery ticket winners here on Earth, and it's very special. Something happened here. You know, microbial life existed on Earth for billions of years before it became complex life. And then the third stage, of course, as Chris says, intelligent life. And yes, I guess he is right. He has a point that what allowed us to become intelligent and to develop our brains and consciousness and civilization are certain accidental traits that nature has hit upon that are convenient and very good ideas. So it may well be that that is the only way for intelligent life to evolve. So it may well be that, you know, they will have eyes to see electromagnetic waves. They will have mouths to send vibrations through atmosphere as sound waves. They may have, you know, digits to manipulate and be dexterous. They may not look that far from us, but you know, now we're into the realm of speculation.
Darian says on Twitter, fear of aliens stems from a belief that we are special, as if there's something we have that could not be found elsewhere easily. You know, Jim, I'm thinking of the question that you ask in the introduction of the book, which is, why would the universe be apparently so finely tuned for life to exist, yet harbor it in just one isolated corner? Build out a little bit on that, will you?
Yes, I think, you know, we know that the conditions that were needed to be in place for life to emerge on Earth were very special. You know, not only is the Earth in the Goldilocks zone in the solar system, not too hot, not too cold, like Goldilocks and Three Bears Porridge. It has water, but also, you know, Earth is protected from the bombardment of rocks from space and meteors by you know, our moon, by Mars, by Jupiter. We have an atmosphere, but also lots of other conditions had to be just right for life to evolve. But the universe is so vast that it does seem, I mean, this, it almost verges on metaphysics and philosophy now. You say, if the universe is so vast, how come? How come everything is so finely tuned for us? Now, of course, if you have a religious faith, you'll say, well, you know, the creator designed things and tweaked the dials to allow us to exist. Now, there are many scientists who are religious, but the purpose of science is to see if we can explain things based on, you know, reasoned argument that doesn't appeal to the supernatural. And in that case, we say, well, you know, there must be many other places. Life must be quite flexible and can evolve with in all sorts of conditions, that just those that led to a life on Earth may not be the only way that life could emerge.
You know, Jim, you've touched on something that I wanted to ask you about, which is how religion influences, you know, our conception about what life on another planet is like. And I'm curious about the scientists that you know who identify as religious, how that influences their work in this field.
I mean, I have to say that the scientists that I know that are religious tend to work in an area of science, by and large, where science and religion don't sort of butt up against each other and cause some conflict. So, you know, if you're a laser physicist or an engineer or whatever, you know, you walk into the lab believing in a divine creator, that doesn't influence how you do your work. But many of those scientists who work on, say, cosmology, for example, and the origins of the universe, you tend to find, by and large, they're not religious, or that they want to answer as many questions as they can without appealing to the supernatural, because that's, I guess, the nature of the scientific method. I mean, if we think back, I mean, I think if we found life elsewhere, it would be a tremendous jolt, you're right, jolt to our feelings of being special, in the same way that when Copernicus and Galileo proved that the Earth goes around the sun and that we are not at the center of the cosmos, you know, the church in Rome had spent a long time before they would accept it, because it knocked humans off their pedestal as being sort of, you know, special creations of God. Finding life elsewhere would do a similar sort of thing, not knocking our ego. But, you know, we'll adjust, as we always do.
To the phones to Dennis in Minneapolis. Hey, Dennis, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
How are you doing?
Doing well. What's your question?
I heard the an observation be made earlier. I think you had said it about that we look at alien life or intelligent life through our own lens, through our own experience here on Earth.
Right.
And, you know, just expanding on that comment, you know, what would intelligent life entail in terms of systems, structures, ethics, law, you know, on that planet or with that intelligent life? And how would we, how might they have dealt with things like equity and have certain mastery over things that we have had challenges with on this planet? We have a series of wars. We have destruction. We have genocide. We have massive equality issues. We have starvations. How would that assessment reverberate back towards the way we handle our intelligent life here, you know, given our observation, our possibility of looking at intelligent life through our own experience, which has been destructive, warlike, so on and so forth? You know, what are the chances of dealing with intelligent life that is so far beyond that, that there's virtually no war? There's no concept or ethos of classism or inequity, of these types of things that impact our human experience on this earth. And just, I just wanted to comment on that earlier comment that you had made here.
Yeah, and I think I hear what Dennis is saying, Jim, about maybe it is impossible for us to imagine that because that's the world we know and understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's even more difficult. We talk about in creating aliens, intelligent aliens in our own image physically, but when it comes to trying to impose on them human emotional states, then absolutely there's no reason for us to think that they would feel happiness, anger, envy, whether they would, you know, want to, you know, be involved in a power struggle to control, you know, all of those. Yes, there are certain traits that that we see in other life forms, other animals, and the mammals certainly here on Earth. But many of the more sophisticated emotions are unique to humans, and there's absolutely no reason for us to think that an intelligent life form would have any interest in those sorts of emotional states.
Jim, this has really been a pleasure. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again about science and astrobiology and the quest for life on other planets. Could we do that again sometime?
Oh, I hope so. I've got plenty more to say.
And I have a lot more to ask, so thank you. We'll talk again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jim Al-Khalili is editor of Aliens, the world's leading scientist on the search for extraterrestrial life, and he was with us today from Surrey, England.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.